This is side B of the first tape of an interview with Florence Soltis. We're in Chapel Hill, North Carolina on August 28, 1998. The interviewer is Malin Glessman, and the tape number is 82898-FS. Since we were talking at the end of the other side about some of these policy issues in terms of life support and right to die debates, before we started the interview, you were telling me about your family's personal experience with that, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I'd be glad to. It certainly was probably three of the most difficult years of my life. My brother was a professor at University of Rhode Island in Brown, and he and his family had lived in Rhode Island for many years and had two children. And Marcia, my sister-in-law, was a very quiet, private person who played the piano beautifully, gardened well, and who was a stay-home mom, was talking about going back to school for a master's, had an undergrad degree in chemistry. And she was a runner. She ran 5 miles a day. Very trim, you know, myself being a little more than a little overweight, she would always tease me, etc. And she had run that morning, and this is in January of 86, and she and Glenn had gone to the grocery store, and she developed this terrible headache that was unbearable. Hospital was within 3 or 4 miles. He drove her over, and what was interesting was that that hospital had just gotten a CAT scanner within that week.
Wow.
So they scanned her and realized that she was having a massive cerebral aneurysm. Of course, had to medicate her because of the pain, and very quickly she was unconscious.
Mm-hmm. Because of the medication or the stroke or both?
Probably both. Uh-huh. I don't know. I assume it was both. Mm-hmm. Because the bleeding was so ferocious, apparently. Mm-hmm. So what they said was they called the neurosurgeons at Brown, Rhode Island Hospital, which was probably about 30 miles away to Providence, and sent her blaring there, my brother following. And they did probably about 7 or 8 hours of surgery, not knowing that the percentage of her surviving the surgery was low, but here's a woman who's 45 years old, very active, involved, and so you want to do that.
With
you
young children? Wow.
The children were high school. Mm-hmm. The daughter was 15, and I think Brian was 17, the son. So teenagers. Mm-hmm. So she survived the surgery, came out on total life supports. There was a lot of hope, you know, among all of us that she would come out of it. Also, reality told us that probably not. But hope springs eternal. And this was just such a shock. So after 6 weeks went by, we began to talk, and the last visit here, which had been the summer of that year, Marcia and I had talked, and she was talking to me about, she read a lot, she was a great reader, and she had read a lot about what was the young lady who that was the first person to get the respirator removed in New Jersey?
Karen
Quinlan. Thank you. One of the things about aging is it flies by, but often it comes back. Karen Ann Quinlan. And she had read about her, and she was talking to me about her in relationship to hospice. And she said, you know, they had taken her off the respirator, and she survived because she was tubed and fed for several years later. And she said to me, you know, I think that was so cruel that they did that. And we talked on about it, about people's rights, etc. And then she said to me, and looked me straight in the eye, and she said, you know, if that ever happened to me, you wouldn't let them do that, would you?
Put her on life support, you mean?
She said, if that ever happened to me, you wouldn't let me do that. You wouldn't let them do that to me, would you? Because I think that's so cruel. Hmm. And I said, of course not. Never thinking that, you know, someday I'd have to live with this, with making a commitment. And so I told my brother about it, because it was really beginning to eat into me that, you know, she had been clear. And he said, well, you know, there were no, there was nothing in Rhode Island at that time, no legislation that would have, that she could have signed or, you know, other than verbalization to have it once expressed. And who at 45, when you run 5 miles a day, think that you're going to have to make a decision like that?
Right.
So anyway, we talked about it. Her father was dead, but we talked with her mother and the children, and my brother met with the neurosurgeons and decided to ask them to remove the her off the respirator.
But not the feeding tube?
No.
The tummy.
The feeding tube had been put in.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, they were still doing physical therapy and so forth. But we decided that if she couldn't survive off the respirator, that maybe we should let her go. And what we thought was that this probably would happen. People were prepared for it to happen. But she had enough brainstem function to continue to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And so she did. Shortly thereafter, she's intensive care at Brown University. Shortly thereafter, she developed an infection. So they had to go back in. The fluid was not draining, and put in a shunt to drain the fluid. And when they did that, it became extremely apparent how bad the damage was, because her head caved in, the cerebral area down to her eyebrows. It was quite clear there was no cerebral functioning in the brain, only the stem left that kept her cardiovascular and respiratory system, etc., working. She stayed in intensive care at Brown for 7 months. And even though my brother was a professor there, they said, you know, we just can't, she's chronic, you know, this can't, we can't keep her in intensive care bed. Which we understood.
Yeah.
Nursing home wouldn't take her. She needed intensive nursing care, termed everything. No response with anything. We took music in, the children did all the things, you know. This is her every day, and there was no response.
Ever, from the moment of
she
this happened,
out,
there was
right.
never any response
before
after
she
the
even
surgery.
Went to Brown. Well, she was already, she was unconscious when she was transferred to Brown. After that, there was never anything. So, in the meantime, time marches on, and what do you do with her? So she was put in General Hospital in Cranston. It's a big campus like Dorothea Dix is the best way I can describe it to you here, except there's a hospital for people who have severe illness, physical illness. Many people have had massive strokes, whole variety of things, low, you know, non or low functioning. And on that grounds is, you know, big, another big mental health hospital and prison, etc. I mean, it's the big sort of state thing. And she was in a, she loved the ocean, and she was in a private room which had a magnificent view of the ocean. And every time I would go in, it would bring tears to my eyes because I thought, how much she would enjoy this, you know, if only she could see and take it in, and how well she was living. It was on the upper story of the hospital. In the meantime, the bills are clicking away. So
was the insurance paying for?
Well, this, my brother had Blue Cross Blue Shield in Rhode Island, and anytime I read the policy, I knew they were going to pay while she was at Brown, but when she got transferred, when we read the policy, we could see no way. So after a year passed, two neurologists came from New York and Boston and looked at her and said, there's nothing there. And so my brother decided, after we talked a lot, he asked the physician if they would remove the gastrostomy tube.
That must have been a very difficult decision.
Yes. And the physician said he had no trouble doing it, but he had to have permission from the hospital administrator. So we asked, the family asked for a meeting with the hospital administrator. And when you got there, the Attorney General was there.
Of Rhode Island.
Mr. O'Neill was there, right? And Mr. O'Neill said that we could not remove the gastrostomy tube because that was murder. And there was a law against it in Rhode Island. So my brother said to him, I understand that it's a state hospital. We'll move her to another hospital to have it done. And he said, you can't remove her from this hospital. And he then said to us, if you remove her, I'm going, as chief law enforcement officer of Rhode Island, I'm going to charge the family and the physician who does it with first-degree homicide. So at that point, we had a tough decision to make. So we talked and decided that, yes, we were going to do it. And if we all went bankrupt, because at that point we were thinking, we were looking probably at the Supreme Court, that we would do that. That was a value that we shared
And that she had expressly said.
She had expressly said there was no question about that, and that this was sort of the last act that we could give her of love, was to release her from this. Mm-hmm. So then what do you do about an attorney? So my brother is a workaholic, and certainly not a women's, you know, a great, I mean, he was very respectful of women, but it certainly wasn't, you know, that he would have gone out of his way to support a liberation kind of movement for females. But we talked about it, and I said, you know, I think if we could find a good female attorney, we'd do well. And we found someone who was 36 years old, had never tried a major case, and who, but what was so good about her was that when she had been a law student, her husband had had cancer. And the two of them together had made a decision to stop treatment at a certain point and let him go. Mm-hmm. She was far enough away in years to have gone through the bereavement, but she understood what it was like. Mm-hmm. He had not been a machine, so that wasn't an issue for her. So she took the case.
Hmm. What made you specifically look for a woman lawyer?
My feeling was that if they had had the right kind of experiences, they would be very empathetic. Mm-hmm. They would have the law in one hand and the feelings on the other, mm-hmm. which I thought was very important to bring together mm-hmm. in this situation. I guess I thought you had to have both. Mm-hmm. Did a great job.
And you thought a woman would be more likely to have that ability to empathize.
It's a prejudice on my part. I'm on the other end.
Right.
But I was proven true.
Yeah.
So we filed in federal court, because we were suing the state of Rhode Island and the hospital administrator. Mm-hmm. And it was an arduous time. The judge that we drew was Francis Boyle. And I don't know if you remember who Mr. Boyle was or not, or Judge Boyle. He had been the attorney for the Right to Lifers, the national attorney. And, you know, when you don't have a control over the judge, and it makes you sweat blood. But he was a straight shooter, and many people feel he gave the best decision that's been done yet in a case like this. There had been a number of cases in states, like there had been a case in Massachusetts, two in New Jersey, etc., the Job and the Quinlan and the Brophy in Massachusetts. So there had been state courts, but not federal. Mm-hmm. So this put it on a different level. It, of course, began to make the newspapers pretty quickly. The press was quite interested in the whole thing. And we began to sort out who would enter Friends of the Court petitions to support us. Mm-hmm. And a lot of organizations did. Some supported us very quietly in the background. It was such a hot potato politically that they were nervous about openly supporting us. But I guess one of my great disappointments was that the hospice wouldn't support us.
Hmm. Why was that?
Because they had... Some people on the national board objected to removing food and hydration at that time. Hmm. Remember, this was 1985.
Yeah, yeah. So what were some of the organizations that submitted amicus?
The Bar Association, some members of the Medical Society, the Episcopal Church. But what was interesting is that Rhode Island was 99% Catholic. Uh-huh. And we felt that was important. My sister-in-law had been raised as a Catholic, but certainly didn't, you know, she would go to church probably on major holidays, and that was it. So we asked the Bishop of Rhode Island to enter a Friend of the Court petition with us. Mm-hmm. And we actually waited on filing the case, hoping we'd get that. And after waiting for some time and not getting it, we went ahead and filed the petition. And didn't hear anything. We never met the man. And on a Saturday afternoon, he held a press conference after we had filed the case for some weeks, and said that he was entering a Friend of the Court petition because he felt what we were doing was right. He had investigated and released a pretty scholarly kind of reasons for why, and thinking through and so forth. And the man later really took it from a lot of groups, Right to Lifers, and from many other priests and cardinals, etc.
Huh.
So he basically, in many ways, did this on his own and took the responsibility and took a lot of heat for it.
Yeah.
So he, to me, is one of the heroes of this, and I have never met him.
What was his name? What is his name?
Genevieve. Bishop Genevieve.
And I'm not sure if you said your sister, or maybe you said your sister-in-law's name.
Marcia Gray. Marcia Victor Gray. B-I-C-T-O-R. Gray. My brother's Glenn Gray.
Yeah.
So, you know, some people got involved and others didn't. And as it began, there were hearings and things began to heat up and more media was there. We were very staunchly supported by the media. There were times in this country when there'd be 3 and 4 editorials in one day supporting our position. So I never felt that they were not very fair. Mm-hmm. In fact, maybe they even tilted in their favor. However, the attorney general and the hospital director were press conferencing all along and making these outlandish kind of things. We never spoke to the press. We did it privately, but never held a news conference or anything. They were doing it almost weekly and basically just crucifying us. And my brother decided that that was not going to be the tack we were going to take, that we would privately talk to reporters or whatever, but we wouldn't press conference. And so the first clue we got about Judge Boyle was he slapped an order on them that they couldn't hold any more press conferences, the gag order. As we sort of moved along, he stopped it. Other things that happened is they bust in right to lifers to the hospital by the bus load. Who picketed?
The hospital administration did?
No. Well, I don't know who was responsible. I don't know that they were, but somebody was.
Huh.
Because they felt that this was the equivalent of murder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they plaqued murder and all that. And when you go in and out of the hospital, they would be picketing, and we were recognized. So they would scream murder in our face.
As you were going in to visit
Marcia. Right. So this was awful. This was hard. It was hard not to say something back, to look straight ahead and not. And they called my brother's house. He wouldn't change his phone to an unlisted number. He said he wasn't going to do that. There's certain things that, you know, he was not going to do, and that was one of them. And they had a tape recording that they made, which sounded like a chain rattling on metal, and then like someone scratching a blackboard. And it started out very loud, saying murderer, and it'd keep getting lower and lower and lower, unless you hung up the phone. It'd be repeated every time it was called.
Oh my gosh.
So, you know, that was hard to take sometimes.
Yeah.
Maybe nightmares.
Yeah. Did that sort of opposition ever, for you or for him, did it ever make you question your decision?
No.
Or did it make you more steadfast?
Made me more determined to see that her rights were followed.
Yeah.
It hardened me.
Yeah. What about for him? Do you know if he ever...
I think it did for him, too.
Mm-hmm.
My brother continued to teach and carry a full load at the university. He never stopped, but he visited with Marcia every day. Meantime, Brian, they had their 25th anniversary. Brian graduated school, and Karen moved up to graduate school. You know, all these things were happening, and
mm-hmm.
we were telling Marcia, you know, there was no recognition or anything. In the meantime, the bills are clicking away
mm-hmm.
at over $500 a day in the hospital, which mm-hmm. was a lot more money now than it is in those days. And also the lawyer's fees were, you know, clicking up. So we thought that Linda McDonald, who was the attorney, would be very reasonable with the fees. But on the other hand, you knew it was going to be over $100,000 easily. So obviously my testimony, my statement of what she had said to me was very important in the trial. I think that was one of the things that was very hard, because I knew that my testimony was going to be in great part what the decision was going to be made on,
mm-hmm.
and that you know, I could say I was responsible.
Mm-hmm.
Was
it hard because, I mean, what?
I think it was just hard saying it.
Yeah, you know? That this is what she said, and I'm going to stick by it.
Right, and this, because I believe this is right.
Yeah.
But that's still hard to say.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It was painful.
Yeah.
But anyway, this dragged on for 3 years. And the decision was, by Judge, my brother was, I was teaching a class, and when I came home that evening, I got home at 8, I had a phone call to call him as quickly, a recorded message to call him as quickly as I could. And I called him, and he said he was teaching a class, got a phone call saying, would he please be at such and such a place at 4, that Judge Boyle was rendering his decision. So he rendered his decision, and he said that He quoted the Wade Roe case throughout the decision. Mm-hmm. It's really almost every page. And he said that a person, irrespective, under the right of privacy in the Constitution, the First Amendment has, the right to privacy, making decisions about whether they'll accept or reject treatment, and that if they can't, their family has the right to make the decision, and the burden is on the opposite party to prove the family doesn't have the best interest.
Mm-hmm.
And that they would remove the gastrostomy tube in the hospital. But if we chose to move her, that we could move her. But if we chose not to, that he was ordering them to remove it within 30 days.
Hmm.
So we began to look, because of the hostility, we began to look at where we'd move her. And this little community hospital where she had first gone is within just a few miles of their house. My brother received a phone call. Most hospitals wouldn't touch it. It was making the headlines of the paper every day at this point in the national news, etc. But a surgeon called my brother from this little hospital and said he'd like to have lunch with him. He met with him and they talked. And he was a surgeon who was much loved in the community, who was one of these physicians that, when you saw his face, you felt better.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, after he met with Glenn, and he called him the next day, and he said, I've thought about it. And at that point, we still didn't know if the Attorney General would charge the person with murder who removed the gastrostomy.
In spite of all this.
In spite of the court ruling, right. No one knew. There were lots of questions. We also didn't know if they were going to kick it to the Supreme Court. We started preparing to go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So he said to my brother that he would like to move her back to that little hospital in her own community, and he would remove the tube, and he would take the risk of being charged with murder. And he said, but I must prepare the hospital for this, because we also knew there'd be lots of pickets.
Yeah.
And this is a small place. So what he did was he met with the board of directors, and they met with every shift in that hospital and asked them if it would be acceptable then to bring Marsha there after they removed the tube to let her die. Because we thought it'd be about a week, it wound up being 10 days. In fact, no one objected except a person in the record department. And he said, it's the family's decision. For me, it's not right, but I won't stand in the way.
Mm-hmm.
So we had total agreement with us, for this little hospital would take her, and that this beloved surgeon would remove the gastrostomy tube. So at the end of the 30 days, and at the time, which was like 6 o'clock in the evening, we knew they hadn't filed the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
which is what we were waiting. So my brother arrived in his car and met the surgeon at the area of this big hospital where it's loading dock for supplies coming in. The ambulance driver didn't know where he was going, because they didn't want the media to know because of the heat. And he arrived with my brother. They went to Marsha's room and loaded her on a gurney and started to take her out of the hospital. And the directress of nursing arrived and began to throw an utter fit. And my brother said, we're taking her out because now the court, we have a right now.
Yeah.
The 30 days are up. And a young, a middle-aged black woman who was a nursing assistant came in and had helped them load her on the gurney, and apparently the directress of nurses threatened her, and she said, put her hands on her hips, my brother said, put her hands on her hips and said, I'm doing this because it's right. So they took her out and got her in the ambulance, and on I-95 between the two hospitals, the physician removed the gastrostomy tube, so that no facility could be charged, only he, if the Attorney General decided to, which fortunately did not happen. But she was brought to this small hospital. All the nurses around the clock who cared for her were volunteers. And have you ever seen anyone who's been on a tube feeding for years?
No.
Remember I told you Marsha was a tiny little thing that weighed 124. She was over 200 pounds.
Huh.
You would not recognize her. She was not recognizable as the person you knew, because you just get this very bloated, distorted look. When the gastrostomy tube was removed, she began to get rid of these fluids. She played the piano, as I told you earlier, beautifully. Her hands had been in contractures, and her hands began to open, and you could see her fingers again. She still had the leg contractures, of course, and feet. But it was like her body began to relax, because it knew that distorted, weird, grotesque kind of look was now becoming more of her as days passed. So that, and 10 days she survived. I think her cardiovascular system must have been in excellent shape because of all her running. And the fact that she still was young. So we were all around her, around the bed, holding hands, and my brother sat on the bed. When it was very clear, when she shame-stoked and we knew she was gone, we were all telling her goodbye and we'd be fine. And she just quietly gave her last breath. There was no discomfort at the trial. There had been accusations made about all sorts of contortions and all this that people go through if they're not fed and hydrated. And I had seen it from hospice and knew it wasn't true. Certainly it wasn't true with her. She was more like herself. You know, if we covered her top of her head above her eyebrows, she looked like herself again, which was the first time in all the years that she had been ill. It was a painful experience. I think our greatest act of love was letting her go in a way and releasing her body from what it must have been terrible, you know, if there was anything near. I can't imagine how terrible it was. What are some of the other things I'll tell you about? Well, the Right to Lifers picketed, and it wound up that pickets jeered them, and so there got to be this confrontational thing outside the hospital, which we were given a private entrance so that we didn't have to face that.
That's good.
Coming and going. But in the Brophy funeral in Massachusetts, the fireman who had the gastrostomy tube removed that went to state court in Massachusetts, Mrs. Brophy was a friend. And they had she had an open funeral, and they had picketed the funeral and outside the church. And we didn't want that. So we had a very private, all the arrangements had been made, a private service where only people who were invited could come. It was small, and the police blocked the whole radius, and people coming and going were checked with a list, which seems weird.
But given the circumstances.
Right, that's what we felt we needed to do to have privacy. And then people asked me about the money. Shortly after her death, we received a bill for just slightly below $1 million. And Blue Cross Blue Shield quietly paid. They paid the 7 months at Brown and the last 10 days at Rhode Island at the small hospital. But it was the in-between in the state hospital that the bill was here. No family had ever sued for the medical expenses when the person had been obviously given care that they didn't want, that the family didn't want. So our attorney went to the hospital and told them that we were thinking of suing. So they reduced the bill down to not so many thousand that we couldn't sell property and pay it. Or my brother did. I didn't pay it. So it made, he sold some property that he had bought years before, which he hadn't paid that much for, in the area near the ocean, and just paid the bill. I wanted strongly for him to sue. Because I wanted to establish a principle for people. He felt at this point, with the years there, he just couldn't do it anymore. That he was worn out. But what we did do was we sued for the lawyers, for the court, all the legal fees. They were over $100,000. And that was quickly given to us because her constitutional rights were denied her. So apparently when that happens, there's not a question of that. And the decision rendered that, that indeed was the case. So what have we done with this? Well, my brother with the ACLU and the Bar Association and so forth then began to really work rigorously in the legislative body of Rhode Island. He got legislation passed so that state now has good living wills and durable powers of attorney, etc., legislation there. So that was one outcome. And the other outcome was, just to tell you what people in this country are like, we received letters from all over the country, people saying thank you, people saying, my husband has Alzheimer's, and I'm so glad that, we can know now that we don't have to have these things when the person isn't living anymore. And there was publicity about our bills, and so some people wrote letters. I mean, it brought tears to my eyes. I live on Social Security. I have $300 a month, but here's $5. Hmm. So my brother took a long time answering all the letters and returning all the money, thanking the person, of course, for being so thoughtful. But it was overwhelming.
Yeah.
Sort of people that you've never heard of, and you're surprised that, they would take the time to do that. So it's very heartening when you think of humanity and people's caring.
Well, and to have that to counterbalance some of the hostility.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
People a who very make few it more people. Difficult.
And I want to say also that the right to lifers have every right to express their opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I would fight to see that they have that right, because I think it's a really important principle that this country lives by. However, they don't have the right to make the decision for me and my family if we think differently.
Mm-hmm.
I respect their values. I expect the same courtesy back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I disagree with them. Oh, they also petitioned the court to become her guardian.
Huh.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that the Right to Life movement connected so closely with also end-of-life issues.
Oh, yeah. Oh, very much.
Yeah. One thing I wonder about for you and for your brother and for their children, when something like that happens, when someone is very suddenly stricken like that, a natural reaction is to have a lot of anger. You know, why did this happen to us? Why has this happened to her? And then on top of that, to have all of this legal battle to go through, I wonder how... I mean, it's just an unusual sort of experience in terms of going through the long-term illness combined with the legal battles and then the bereavement process so long after the initial event.
Well, in many ways, you have to let the grieving process wait.
Uh-huh.
Because for many reasons. One is because you don't have the energy to deal with the legal issues and grieving, because it tires you out. As C.S. Lewis says in A Grief Revisited, nothing makes you more tired. I could only shave half of my face at a time and rest. Grief is that way. We had to put it on hold because you had to muster the energy to deal with those decisions that were really hard decisions. And not knowing the impact it's going to have on you, your family, etc., not only emotionally but financially as well. As losing Marcia, and what the future might hold. And, we were lucky. We were educated. We were middle class. And I think it's when I look at that and realize how fortunate we were in many ways to be able to have the assets that we needed to deal with this, I look at really poor people with a healthcare system that's fragmented, that's difficult to navigate, and to understand and to really worry about the fact they can't pay for it, and that they'll become homeless as a result of this. And we also face that fact that we could have become homeless out of this. Our children may have not been able to go to college. Those kind of major values that you've put forth in your life may suddenly disappear, and you realize it. And that was difficult because we were facing that on a daily unknown basis for a number of years while this case was in court. So it wasn't just a brief interval. It was a long thing. And yes, I was angry. You probably can still hear some anger in my voice.
Actually, no. That's why I asked the question.
For a long time, I told my brother, this is a terrible thing to admit, particularly on tape.
Well, if you don't.
But that's fine. I remember telling my brother as we walked through the Right to Life first to go in the hospital, I said, I swear I'm going to just spit on them one of the days going in.
Sure.
And he was kinder than I. He would have the coolness, and he'd say, "Oh, don't you dare! It would be headlines. You just look straight ahead,
yeah,
and don't hear anything."
Yeah.
But that was sort of one of the things that I thought of. I had some depression.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get treated.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should have. I probably would have done better had I done so. But little things that didn't bother you suddenly became enormous things that made you angry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your life was in such an upheaval,
mm-hmm,
it was difficult. And for the children, I think, who didn't have peers to really support them,
right,
who hadn't gone through this, they were the people I worried about the most.
Right. Anytime kids that age lose, right, a parent, it would be difficult for that reason.
Well, particularly Karen, the daughter, because she was at a very crucial age where she needed to have her mother as a mentor,
mm-hmm,
role model. And this was difficult. And she's now, I feel, really coming into her own,
mm-hmm,
having gotten over it, because it's taken a while. Really, it's taken a while for her to deal with,
mm-hmm,
it.
She was 15, you said?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she's 29. She's 29 now. Mm-hmm. I think I'm right in my math.
Mm-hmm.
So that I've seen her grow and begin to blossom now.
Mm.
But quite clearly for a long time, you saw the scars and how,
yeah,
painful it was.
Yeah.
And dealing with it and decision-making and choices she made, etc.
Not having that support there.
Right, mm-hmm, right. Well, you know, my brother, of course, her father's still there and very,
sure,
attentive to her, and I was always available. But I'm pretty far away.
Mm-hmm.
During going through this, I was flying up there on a regular basis on weekends, attempting to do what I could do to help, and certainly spoke with my brother via telephone every day. So that, you know, we tried to support each other. The family's not huge.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother was living, and she had a sister, and her sister died of an aneurysm 3 years
You're
after
kidding.
She did.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
But had that run in the family before?
Well, her father died while he was square dancing in his 50s.
Huh.
And we think now, we thought he had a heart attack, didn't do an autopsy.
Uh-huh.
But people wonder,
yeah,
if that isn't what it was now, given the two children. And so we worry about my niece and nephew.
Yeah, I'll bet. Is there any way to
test? Well, we met with a neurosurgeon, and he said, you know, that if it's probably nothing you can do anyway.
Yeah. So how about your nephew? How has he fared in the aftermath?
He's doing well.
Of
this? He's an engineer, has two young children, lives in, mm-hmm, California, does,
mm-hmm,
well.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked me how I managed it. Well, I can tell you how both my brother and I managed it. We had illnesses afterwards.
Huh. Serious?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I had a heart attack. And my brother didn't have a heart attack, but developed terrible chest pains a year later.
Uh-huh.
And had bypass surgery.
Huh. So your body really took on the stress.
Yeah. So I think maybe we're the sort of people that express it through our hearts.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Literally.
Our bodies, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think I can directly attribute, probably, even though, as I told you, three generations of my family have died of heart disease, except,
mm-hmm,
my mother, I think I can, you know, the genetic factor was there. But,
mm-hmm,
I think the stress certainly brought it on,
mm-hmm,
dealing with this.
You know, I wonder both about your conversation with Martha.
Marcia.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
You know, about her wishes were,
mm-hmm,
something like this to happen. And also about the fact that you already worked in this field and,
mm-hmm,
then to go through something like this. I'm not asking, I guess, what do you think accounts for that coincidence, but what... Do these seem to be just coincidences to you, or do you... I mean...
Well, I think she had a lot of interest in the area, and that's what fascinates me.
Uh-huh.
That's why she was so interested in the area.
Yeah.
Because she was also reading a number of the Russian writers and so forth who wrote about death and so forth.
Uh-huh.
We were discussing some of the readings that she was doing, and my older daughter particularly was close to Marcia, and she used to go from Yale to spend the weekends with him a lot, and I think Marcia would sit and knit, and Jackie would read to her from many of the Russian writers, because she was obviously a graduate student in,
right,
the language. And talk about it. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know if this is something that, you know, happened to prepare her to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
I think she talked to me because I was close to her, mm-hmm. and because she knew of my work in hospice, mm-hmm. and this was something that was important to her. Mm-hmm. And I like to think that she thought that I would carry through her wishes, mm-hmm. That I would see that what she wanted would happen, mm-hmm. which I tried to the best that I could. Mm-hmm. It just took a long time.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll say to you how this personally affected me, and professionally. Well, I think I've talked about personal effect. But professionally, as painful as it was, I think we grew as a family tremendously. I think I'm a better person from having had the experience. Not that I don't need lots of improvement. I think I'm a better social worker. I think I'm much more empathetic to families, that I understand better how it feels.
Yeah.
Though I can't really walk in their shoes, I do know how it feels. And I think it makes me a much stronger advocate for people's rights to make choices, mm-hmm. To celebrate and value life with people. My brother changed. My brother had been a workaholic. He took time to spend with his family, which he does now as well. I think he has some regrets that maybe he hadn't spent more time with Marsha than he should have. Mm-hmm. He takes time to travel now, which he didn't used to. He takes his children with him. He's very active in the two grandchildren's lives. Mm. They're a great joy to him. If he were a workaholic like he used to be, he wouldn't have taken the time to do these things.
Yeah.
So I think it impacted. And I often tell people, I've never yet talked to a person who is dying who told me they had regrets that they hadn't spent more time at the office.
Right. Right.
So I think that's something that, you know, certainly rang true in our family.
Uh-huh.
And probably a lot of families.
Uh-huh.
You know, is looking at that, sort of putting it into perspective.
But yeah, they're all different sorts of work. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the sort of, depending on the sort of work that you do, that at the end of your life, you would be either more or less glad that you had spent your time that way,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that, do you think that there are good deaths and bad deaths and in-between deaths? Or do you think they're just deaths and they're all different?
Oh, I think there are good deaths. I think there are people who've lived and done what they wanted, and who to the end remain in character as their lives have been,
mm-hmm.
And often are very happy to release themselves, depending on the situation that they're in. I go to a lot of nursing homes,
mm-hmm.
the people who are older with lots of problems, and I must say it makes me very sad when I walk down a corridor and hear older people crying to die, wanting to be released from where they are. And my thoughts are often, what can we do to enhance their life so that this is not so unhappy for them,
mm-hmm.
that they have to beg? And yet I see, you can see young people on drugs, alcohol, or accidental deaths, and you know, I consider drugs and alcohol a suicidal gesture.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
just slow.
Mm-hmm.
And very destructive. But why are they so unhappy that they have to resort to this? And I think those are bad deaths.
Mm-hmm.
Very sad.
Mm-hmm.
Because the person hasn't been able, because of whatever the reason, probably many multivariate, to be able to be themselves and meet their potential.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I guess my heroes and heroines are the older black people in rural North Carolina. I see a lot of them. They didn't have any opportunity to have an education. They've never had many things that probably many of us value, like a nice home and things like that. Many of them have never even owned a car.
Mm-hmm.
And they've worked very, very hard. And yet these are some of the most generous people that I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
They value their families. They value their fellow man. Their religion is a great solace to them, almost always.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people that I think never really get celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the people that I think really need to be celebrated and have an opportunity to leave their stories behind, to tell what it was like to live through segregation,
mm-hmm.
what it was like not to be able to go to school, what it was like to live in a shack in the rural area, and, you know, the woman who cleaned 5 white people's houses every day for the whole years of their life, did it when they were in their 70s still, because their Social Security won't cover the costs that they have to buy their needs, to meet their needs. So I guess these are the people I feel like I work for at the university. We never had an opportunity to come to the university, and yet have more good common sense than many PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not putting down PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
But I just feel like these people were pragmatic, they're survivors, and they really care.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the reasons I love the university is because I feel like I work for the people of North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
and I feel like they own the university.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe sometimes we forget that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think their stories are what makes, and their lives, to state what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's changing. It's changed a lot in 23 years I've been here.
When you go out to rural North Carolina, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. visit these older black folks, what do you feel like, as a part of the university, or just as yourself, what do you bring them?
Well, I go out, of course, as part of a healthcare team.
Mm-hmm.
Because we go